The other thing that we have to talk about in Jonnet's storyline is the fact that the Mariner showed up. I initially wanted to cap all of the storylines that we had with action scenes, because I think action is important to be a part of the world of Skyjacks. Even when we were going through these emotional explorations, I do want action to be there, and I do want rolling to be involved in some way. I also kind of knew the resolution that would take place no matter what. Like, you know, there's a chance that Teacher Wei could have died. There's a chance maybe that Jonnet could have maintained a Mariner's Mark, what have you. But, like, I knew Jonnet was going to rebuke the Mariner with the song I Am a Mountain, because I Am a Mountain is a result of a collaboration between Arnie Parrott and Tyler Davis that started back with our album. Like, the two of them were talking about doing some kind of collaboration on music. I was all for it. You know, it depended on the budget, what have you. So I can't even remember if we hit the goal for that collaboration to definitively go through or not. But, like, you know, they kept me abreast of, like, ideas that they had. And they had this concept album that they wanted to do, or concept EP, where Jonnet, it's an alternate universe where Jonnet is a rapper from Chicago. And they did a couple tracks together on that. And I Am a Mountain is one of them. And they shared it with me. And I was like, I would like to find a way to make this an essential part of the arc. Like, I love the music that's here. I love kind of the declarations that are happening here. I love everything about the way that this is presented. I want this to be in the show, even if like the core of this is like, oh, this is taking place in an alternate universe or whatever, like, it, these words have a place in this character's mouth. So, like, I knew that I Am a Mountain was the big climax of whatever confrontation with the Mariner. But the scenes that we ended up doing along the way as we were building to that action beat ended up taking much longer than I anticipated. Because we went farther into detail. Like, these were not indistinct things. Like, in each one, we kind of went on an emotional journey and learned something important and essential about these characters, particularly Jonnet, like, flashing back to the island and the first time that he took a life with Polaris. Like, that was a lot longer and a lot more detailed, and we made a lot more discoveries than I thought we would with it, which are good things that I want to embrace, but also, Lex is a busy person. It is hard to schedule everybody. And like, Lex being on the East Coast, Tyler being on the West Coast, there's a huge time differential, other things. I felt bad about taking up this artist's time and, like, constantly asking for more time. I think I had scheduled originally 3 sessions with Lex, but being like, I'm going to try and aim to do this in 2. And we ended up needing to do all 3. So I was like, asking for a 4th is just, it's too much. So when faced with it, when the Mariner had to come, because I did want to address the Mariner's Mark. The Mariner's Mark, you know, showed up, I think, because of a luminary pole back in Nordia. It wasn't an overall plan that I had for the character. I didn't want it to be an overall pervading thing. And, like, also, like, a lot of people talk about the Mariner being the be-all end-all of the setting. And in certain ways, yes, the Mariner is an expression of a very particular type of colonial violence that is kind of the roiling threat behind all of the other types of colonial violence that we examine in the show. Like, when you look at the economic damage done by the Red Feathers and taking resources, or, like, the cultural damage done by the Church of the Slain God and things like that, like, those are all bad, but, like, the force behind it is always kind of, we're just going to come and kill everybody and destroy everything that is beautiful here. And so, yeah, that makes the Mariner a tremendously important villain, and, like, something that, you know, should be fought against and whatnot. And the circumstances in which the Mariner has been faced up to, like, really throughout the podcast, we've always seen a reduced version of the Mariner. First off, in Bujaneeth, there was a spell purifying the water that was weakening, but not destroyed. So there's already that protection in place. We had Traveler Quan there who knew how all of this stuff worked and was guiding Jonnet through it a little bit. And all that needed to be done was a ceremony needed to take place to you know, strengthen and reaffirm a protection that was kind of already there. So that wasn't a true confrontation. Then in Nordia, I had made sure that the landscape of Nordia would not allow a full fleet of drowned sailors up. More than that, everybody kind of like prepared for this. There was advanced warning and they had a lot of resources. So the Mariner was not able to like appear full strength in Nordia. And also, there was this cultural festival that happened to be happening at the same time that provided them a way to like use, you know, more than 300 years worth of like cultural power to banish him from this place. So like, you know, the Mariner is fighting. The Mariner doesn't have the support and power that he normally draws on. There aren't really drowned sailors everywhere causing too much of a havoc because, like, they have partially, like, warned everybody there. They're ferrying people to the Uhuru. So there are fewer opportunities for drowned sailors to do all this damage. And, like, you know, he sent one of his heralds up there and then shot himself into the herald and had to consume a lot of drowned sailors to like do a lot of the magic and things that he was doing. Orimar shows up unexpectedly. Jonnet is getting support from his future self. Like things are happening to make this confrontation with the Mariner. There is a reason that that fight is won. And I kind of stand behind that. Then here we are showing up in Teacher Way's pocket space, like this dreamlike area where the only connection that the Mariner really has to Jonnet is this faint thread of the Mariner's mark. Jonnet is like in the earliest stages of affliction with this curse at this point. Like it hasn't advanced. He's not getting like contacted by the sea or called out or any of these things. And also the Mariner is currently engaged in an ancient deal between luminaries where the Forest Queen is acting as like a mediator between him and the Rasalka that prevents him from going into this space. So the hold that the Mariner has on Jonnet in this instance is very, very light. It is very indistinct. The reason that he's reaching out and attacking right now is Jonnet is also in a place that could be very vulnerable. He is like deep in his psyche, in kind of like this spiritual realm where, you know, there is a difference between punching someone in their body and like punching someone in their soul. And that's kind of what the Mariner was going after in this. But still, he's not able to bring a lot of power to bear there. So I was going to have a fight scene with Teacher Way and Jonnet in the pocket space. But like we simply did not have time for it. And at the end of the day, I was kind of evaluating like all of this is kind of leading up to more character development for Jonnet. And I asked myself the question, is the Mariner at this point actually important to Jonnet's story? You know, the thing that we found as we looked into Jonnet's past through some of the world building and talks that Tyler and I have had is he doesn't have a specific grudge against the Mariner. The Mariner is a bad force in the world, and that's bad, and Jonnet is good, and therefore Jonnet like kind of stands in opposition to that, but like it's not like the Mariner killed his mom. It's not like there's a personal grudge between him and the Mariner because the Mariner took something from him. Jonnet was kind of like in a position where like I'm powerful. I have all of this potential. I'm going to take a shot at the biggest thing that I can see And that's the Mariner. So I was like, well, if the Mariner isn't super important to Jonnet specifically at this juncture in his life, then that kind of signals to me that, like, he doesn't even really deserve to have this hold on Jonnet. Like, we know these two are going to come to blows. But, like, it's not out of revenge. It's because it's the right thing to do. That kind of led me, like, well, let's actually sever this personal connection, especially because we're talking about Jonnet's goals. And although Jonnet didn't, like, really define these goals, and, like, we are going to have to do that later on in another part of our story, separating Jonnet from, like, oh, the goal has to be that I need to separate myself from this thing that I did when I was young because I was trying to help people, that doesn't feel like it is a useful part of this protagonist story. Like, I genuinely and sincerely want none of Jonnet's hero's journey to be stuff that is forced on him. Like, that is part of the classic hero's journey, that you have the call to adventure that you, like, initially decline. Jonnet sought out life as a corsair. Jonnet joined the Uhuru on his own initiative. Jonnet saw a version of himself that was strong and cool, and he decided that he wanted to take the steps to do that, disconnected from everything else, including wanting to do something with that power. I think that is kind of a beautiful part of Jonnet's story, and I don't want to mire it in, like, classic tropes or whatever. So, yeah, did we have, like, someone who is a big bad of the setting kind of get banished without a single role? Absolutely. Part of that was a timing issue, but the other part of it is I think that makes a better story. So, that's Jonnet and Way's part of this. Let's talk a little bit about Travis and Orimar's part of this, because, like, so much cool stuff happened here. A really funny thing about this wing of the plot was how much stuff was completely unplanned. I had originally kind of wanted to have Travis's plot be flashbacks, kind of like what was happening with Gable and Jonnet, but so that we could get more of a relationship between him and Raoul, so that basically there was more narrative weight to everything that we were doing with it. But it ultimately became a lot more important to spend time with Travis and Orimar. And also, it took them a long time to really get spun up on actually what they were doing. I wanted to have this be a hunting in the woods kind of thing. I definitely wanted it to be in a naturalistic environment instead of an urban environment, because I think the expectation that Travis would have as a character is like, oh yeah, I'm hunting down this, you know, former fellow con artist in an urban environment, because that's where kind of I'm used to operating and where I know him from. And, like, it would be obvious, like, how much had, like, changed for this person. But we spent a lot of time between the metaphysician and the boat ride and so many other things getting Travis to where he needed to be, that we just didn't have time for a lot of Raoul stuff, which I do feel bad about, because I was kind of excited to, like, learn more about Travis's past with a character other than Gable, or Margaret for that matter. And I, you know, really just didn't end up with that opportunity. So I feel Raoul got kind of underserved. We did have, like, that tiny snippet of a scene with Raoul where we got to see there was almost a mirroring of personality between Raoul and Travis. Like, he was also sort of snarky and whatnot. But I also kind of wanted it to be sort of a dark mirror to some of the things that Travis is dealing with, where you have this other changeling who has been around for so long and is kind of out of ways of dealing with it, who made more deals and tried to escape and whatnot, and ended up getting all of his humanity stripped away from him. Especially because Travis is now kind of coming into his own, and, like, through this arc, especially as the changeling, I wanted to make explicit, like, the ways Travis could run his life differently, but how that would kind of necessitate embracing like things that he normally runs away from, and how, you know, just being clever and tricky and all of these things was only going to get you so far in deals with this cosmic force. Like, Raoul, I think, got dealt a little bit short shrift, but I do think some of the thematic weight was still there. It's not what I would have wanted. And again, if we kind of had the longer sprawling plot that I envisioned for this arc, you know, Gable could have been around. There could have been, you know, more dialogue about Travis's past and whatnot. But what we did kind of get to do was focus on Travis and Oromar, and Oromar following Travis around on like something that Travis needed to do, and getting to unpack his thought process a little bit. And we came down then to the bet, which is something that I feel pretty contentious about. It is not something that I planned, obviously. This is something that Nathan and Johnny came up with together, and it was so cool. Like, definitely having Travis, like, have to gamble about gambling, a thing that he does all the time, was really, really cool. A great way to challenge Travis's ongoing sort of like character foibles. The issue was, I do think a bet about like, hey, don't bet anymore, is a little bit too easy in a narrative context where there aren't other characters around, really. It was just Travis and Oromar. Who is Travis going to gamble with? So it needed to extend beyond like just bets that Travis could have with people. However, I think the solution that I came up with for it was really inelegant and ill-defined. We didn't get a lot of time to talk through, okay, this is what the mechanics for this situation should be, because that will be interesting and compelling. We were really already pretty short on time, so we kind of had to skip over it, and I don't think anybody really knew the rules by the end of it, including the audience, which makes it one of the weaker parts of the arc. Though I think it will yield interesting fruit, even though if I could, the way that we got there, I would probably redo. But yeah, like we also got to see a lot of cool transformation stuff. And I think it was just, the audience definitely picked up on it. There was a cool energy between Travis and Oromar and kind of how their relationship is developing that I think is really neat, and that I'm very much looking forward to coming to fruition in future arcs. Then we get to Gable's plot. Gable's plot, very simple. I had planned this on being a group adventure. I wanted Gable to be going really with the main cast of characters on an adventure to get an angel feather. Obviously, the structure of this arc had to change that and change it like relatively quickly, and it could suddenly involve no other main characters. So Liz actually, in kind of an unusual way, arrived at the solution for me. Like, I knew that Gable would be going on this adventure and like kind of dealing with the past at the same time. And we had this interaction between Gable and Nodos, because like I needed some character to wake Gable up, and I was playing more, you know, with this like little ship trope that we were running with Nodos having this big hilarious crush on his big hilarious friend. Then Liz did the thing that I did not expect and directly called it out, was directly like, hey, I can tell that you're into me, and I don't know that I can do this right now. And I, you know, I just wanted to have my fun with shipping. I just wanted like there to be one character kind of pining in the background, because I think it is both fun and very funny. It is very funny to have like a cool, tough pirate who speaks like a haunted butler, as JPC put it, like just being in the background, writing like names and notebooks and stuff like that. I think it's adorable. But Liz is like, you know, no, there's going to be character development around this, and calls it out. And so I was like, okay, well, now Nodos and Gable and Wendell are in this together, because like these are also like two characters that we had established as like Gable's kind of buddies. This is Gable's running crew. They do risky things together. They were the boarding party public for the civility. So I wanted to do more about them, especially because in the Silver Bullet arc, we had kind of established that Wendell is probably going to be moving on soon from the Uhuru. And I like Wendell, and I like these characters together. And so I wanted to explore a little bit of that. And now, like out in the open, kind of explore a little bit of Nodos and Gable, because like the issue had been forced in a way. So we had like the treasure that they were after, which was just an angel feather. And I had to come up with a reason that like an angel feather hadn't been claimed yet. And so it was like, yeah, it is at the bottom of a deep well. And initially I was like, well, that just means that it is too deep for anybody to really dive down. And like, they don't have a lot of assisted diving equipment in this setting. And like, it can even be so deep that if you were to like do like a bell and helmet kind of diving situation, that like air wouldn't be able to circulate quickly enough, like, and maybe too tight to get a bunch of machinery in it. Like, so yeah, I was like, these are in these caves, these mysterious caves, which we barely got to explore, which was such a cool part of the Dumignon setting, but like we just didn't have time for it. So like I wanted to show off a little bit. You know, we came up with a bioluminescent rope that needs to eat blood, and like, you gotta show off an idea like that. That's so cool. And came up with the treasure caverns and whatnot. So I was like, okay, we're still going to do this. We're still going to have a journey through the treasure caverns. It's going to be abridged, and it's going to kind of be this buddy thing. And I had for a while wanted to talk a little bit about processing disability and pain and recovery through Wendell. Wendell being a character who, like, you know, gets a miraculous treatment that you can kind of point to Dreff's necromancy as like, oh, this is a way of erasing disability from Skyjacks, because like, you know, if this were the real pirate world, you know, they would have had to like amputate Wendell's arm to prevent like it from getting infected and killing him. But, you know, this is a world with magic and magical healing, partially because magical healing just makes it convenient that you can have characters who can get into dangerous situations and have bad things happen, but also continue playing with them next week. It's important that that exists. So we are hand-waving violence and injury somewhat, because that is kind of what the convenience of like adventure and actual play like asks you to do. Like, even if you look at something like Our Flag Means Death, like there's so much stabbing in that show that would absolutely kill these characters, and they just don't address it. It's like a character gets stabbed one episode and the following episode they're fine. And that's good, actually. I think you shouldn't always be looking at that. But with Wendell, we did have this opportunity to show like, well, we do have this magical healing, and Wendell is very lucky and even feels very lucky. It's still hard to recover. And like, he can't feel his arm. His arm is stronger than it ever has been, and he can't control it. And that kind of mirrors the way that he sees himself. You know, he is like this person who is a wild pirate who likes to get in dangerous fights and take big risks. And that's kind of all he has ever seen himself as. And in retiring, in like going to, you know, live his life with his spouses, his role is not that anymore. So if like you see yourself as a being meant for violence and made for peace, and that fundamentally can't be controlled and is too strong and does unintentional damage, like that's really hard. So I wanted to really investigate that. I had originally envisioned Wendell getting up in front of the Grand Fire and talking about it, but in writing it out, I just didn't feel like it didn't feel authentic enough to me. I have very limited experience with injury and recovery. Like, I have, in my parkour days, suffered injuries that have left me less capable than I would be without those injuries. However, like, that capability is, you know, it's not a day-to-day concern for me. So it was harder to write that from a truly authentic place. But now having this thematic connection, especially like Wendell is planning on leaving piracy and he's not going to be around all of this wild violence anymore. And like for his for his bachelor party, he had elected to go hunt Leviathan, which is an incredibly dangerous thing that you probably like, there is a reasonable chance that you're not coming back from. That suggested to me that like, wow, this character is taking a lot of risks before this big important event that is very calm. Why is he doing that? So it became that like, yeah, searching for this thing that is this feather is going to be Wendell's idea. And Wendell is the driving force. And Gable and Nodos are kind of getting dragged along. And I was able then to like really solidify, well, what is this treasure? What is this angel feather? Why do people keep going after it? You know, even if they don't really have a new approach or a real chance of grabbing it. And the thing is that the actual treasure is weirdly sort of the friends you find along the way, in that it is this thing that calls to you at the bottom of this well, and you either dive in and swim down for it and keep swimming until you drown, or you turn back at some point, whether that be after you've already dived in or something else. And like what the treasure actually is that while you are, you know, facing that possibility or indeed swimming down towards it in a place that, like, I don't know how magical it is, but like you can be much deeper than you think you are as you are swimming after this prize. So like it is hard to gauge what is safe and what, when and whether or not you'd be able to turn back, those sorts of things. Like the treasure is having the realization that you have things to live for, that are more important than like some kind of treasure or glory. So like Wendell like kind of catches wind of that. And it's like, this is sort of a chance for me to test, like, if I am just someone who is unfit to live a peaceful life and would present more of a danger to the people that I love than a good partner and like asset. Is it better if I just am not part of that and don't disappoint anyone and I die trying to claim treasure as part of the Uhuru crew, so those people that I love are going to be cared for and whatnot? You know, they're like, they're tough thoughts that, you know, Wendell is not really talking to anyone about, and he decides like the catalyst of it is going to be this quest. And so then I have Nodos, who is, you know, dealing with these feelings. And like, I think if you've ever had a crush, sometimes the important thing about a crush is that it's private and is that it's a fantasy. It's a thing that like you think about, oh, wouldn't it be nice? But like part of it is it's important to you that you never act on it because you don't want to disrupt or threaten the stability of the life that you are living with this person. You don't want to disrupt the life or stability that you are living with this person that you have the crush on. So you're like, I have these feelings, you know, they do come up occasionally, but I am trying to not let them get in the way. And I figure, you know, what we can have is a Nodos coming to this room in this situation and actually being like, well, you know what? I really do need to confront these feelings because like we live in a way where people can die, and maybe I just need to call them out in the open and leave them be after having said my piece. Or, you know, maybe something can come of this, what have you. Like, I felt like this challenge, this treasure, was a really good catalyst for that character to sort through those feelings, because, again, the issue got forced. Like, that conversation needs to happen now, because it has been called out into the open. We can't just do the sitcom thing where people pretend they didn't hear the very obvious thing that they heard. And having Wendell both, like, sweep them both up into a position where they can't really talk about it because they're trying to be there for their friend is kind of a perfect way to extend it and let the story kind of happen on its own, at its own pace. Meanwhile, you have Gable, who literally cannot be destroyed by drowning. We have established that they are immortal in that sense, in that, like, they can drown time and time again, as they did the 10 times after they fell from the sky. We know that. So no matter what, no matter how far it is, Gable's kind of going to be able to claim this feather. And I had originally thought it would be cool, rather than intersperse these flashbacks through the arc, for Gable to dive into the water and for that to have the entire star-crossed, like, segment of this arc take place after that dive and just kind of take over the show for a little bit. Ultimately, though, like, I think I had mentioned that, like, oh, Gable did remember everything from the star-crossed thing beforehand. Like, there was a line that made that approach to it hard to justify. Like, we would have had to cut that. And also, God, what was the other thing? Oh, yeah. Like, I felt like if it took over the show too much, it might feel less fun. There were a lot of, because Starcross is a thing that happens scene by scene, it, like, paces itself in an interesting way. And, like, it is strong enough to split up, is maybe even stronger splitting up, because you do get a bunch of mini cliffhangers throughout. So ultimately, like, instead of just, yeah, plunging into the water is the time, like, the whole time Gable is going on this fun friend adventure, they are also kind of impacting, they are also kind of unpacking, like, this cosmic relationship baggage that they're dealing with. And beginning to understand the next essential thing about the story, which kind of, about their story, which kind of overrode what I wanted this arc to be. I wanted originally, like, Gable to, like, have to confront the fact that, like, yeah, wow, people had to make a lot of adjustments and allowances to their life here because the stars fell, and to play on the guilt aspect of that before we did the star-crossed flashback, so that, like, we got to see Gable wallow a little bit in the feeling of I ruined the world. Instead, we managed to compress that without really looking too much about how the world was affected. We just got to know that Gable has been silently feeling that. And for goodness knows how long, but, you know, definitely post-Nordia, like, where they know for sure that they slew the Sovereign, like, that has been bouncing around. And I think Liz even said on air, like, it's a thing that is, like, too cosmic to reconcile. Like, I killed God, how I eat oatmeal for breakfast. Like, yeah, we know that they've been carrying that weight, but, like, we learn through the star-crossed arc, or the star-crossed portion, that, like, they had reasons for slaying the Sovereign. And although it wasn't at the time, like, those reasons affected the way that the Sovereign treated humanity, and, you know, what was certainly the focus, the way that the Sovereign treated the angels. It was all not good, that, you know, even though the world suffered a lot after the Sovereign fell, under the Sovereign's rule, the world was suffering anyway. Gable was commanded to commit these, like, atrocities in the name of the Sovereign's justice, and, like, the justice is for what? This is the same being that created angels as beings who are capable of love and then commanded them not to feel it. And punished them for it. So it's like Gable is sort of unwinding that, like, yes, my actions did things that, like, left a dramatic impact on this world, but also knowing the reason behind those actions and in the ways that they were kind of justified. There is a lot to all of that that Gable is going on. And I felt that, like, this little portion of the arc I was really, really happy with. I loved Wendell's portion. I loved Nodos's portion. I loved Gable's journey throughout it. It was funny and lighthearted. It had that amazing, like, blood cellars scene. And, you know, it catalyzed itself in, like, this amazing emotional climax of Gable diving in and Nodos telling them to be careful. And Gable also saying that, like, hey, I can't do this right now, but I want to be the type of person who can. Like, a really, really cool moment. Which brings us to something that was brought on by sort of, like, overarching necessities. One of the things that made us cut this arc short, and we'll address it in future arcs. Like, you will see why this arc had to be cut short, but it did mean more information had to flow out of this arc in order to accommodate that pacing, which is why Rusalka showed up. Why Rusalka appeared in front of everybody and talked and let out a little bit of exposition that taught us some very essential things. This was partially initiated by Travis having the unexpected scene with the Morrigan in Ungoni and learning a little bit about himself and that the story of the changeling is broken. And I had decided this a long time ago, and I really, really wanted to bring into the plot that, like, the story of the changeling is broken because it's not supposed to be a tragic story. Like, part of this, there is a thematic connection to a lot of, and the Decembrists are drawing in a lot of different places to tell the story of Hazards of Love. So I don't want to pigeonhole them and say that, like, oh, this is the one influence. But Tamlin is a big influence for the Hazards of Love. And that is a story fundamentally where a human confronts the supernatural horror of, like, the fey world and wins, you know, and love wins. For those who don't know, like, the Forest Queen holds, like, somebody in their power, and a woman basically is like, no, I love this person. I want to be with this person. And the Forest Queen's like, well, if you can hold on to them, you will keep them, and transforms their love into, like, all of these terrible things that is, like, very painful and very difficult, but she holds on through the whole affair and in the end wins over the Forest Queen and love. And, like, I think it's the Fairy Queen or whatever. But the point is, like, it is a story that fundamentally is about love. And also, you know, I'm thinking about this folktale world and, like, kind of origin myths and the fact that the Forest Queen being a luminary and being an essential part of this world, having a relationship with the sovereign and all of that, that there should be kind of a more naturalistic story, especially because the Forest Queen is a being that outside of Skyjax would primarily be representing nature, right? And, you know, only one of her themes in the Luminary deck is nature. The rest is kind of attached to the story of Hazards of Love, which is telling something that, like, contravenes nature in a way, because Hazards of Love is, like, about a jealous mother who doesn't want her child to move on and have a life of his own and destroys the child and the love that he has. And it's tragic because that's not how the world is supposed to work. You're supposed to, like, empower your children to grow up and not, like, expect them to bend to your will. So it's like, fundamentally, there is something broken about this story. And I kind of thought about natural cycles and the nature of, like, the maiden, mother, and crone in, like, stories about witchcraft and whatnot. And it ultimately led me to believe that, like, yeah, what we have here is a story that naturally should be about the relationship between humanity and nature, though it is kind of, like, complicated and fraught, the relationship between humanity and, like, human civilization, and how that is a fundamental part of our place in the world. Like, and we still have, like, stepping outside of nature, stepping into a supernatural world where you've got an abandoned child who, instead of dying the way an abandoned child would, is adopted by a supernatural force and given freedom from Yes, yes, Falcon, yes. Given freedom from some of the dangers of the natural world, like he doesn't get sick, he doesn't age, he doesn't have to get involved in conflicts. All of that is part of this and part of like the queen sort of doing this. You know, we don't get a super clear motivation in I've been trying to avoid the baby sounds, and I think I got to embrace them at a certain point because we're not going to be without them. Yes, yes, Falcon, yes. Eat daddy's hand. So there's that aspect, like the Forest Queen takes on this child. And makes them the changeling. And then the maiden comes along when the changeling is... Wow, you're making this real hard, Falcon. The maiden comes along when the changeling is an adult and kind of like ready to experience love and be a person. How, like, even if you strip away the threats that humanity faces and that other living beings face, like, you can't strip away the desire for a human being's desire for connection. And, like, you know, just having a family in a lot of ways isn't enough. Even if you're asexual, even if you're aromantic, you still have connections to other people, and those are important and sacred. So, like, yeah, even if you remove someone from the world of humanity and, like, give them a life that is more peaceful and less challenged, eventually they do need connections with other people. That's where the maiden comes in. The maiden enters the changeling's life through an act of kindness, like just random kindness. The changeling is suffering. Although the human world presents all of these threats and there are challenges outside of like the environment created by this very safe family unit, that there is still kindness in that world and it is worth being connected to that kindness. And the maiden is like worthy of entering this protected world because of that kindness. And also like nature kind of being an essential theme that we want to be picked up in all of this. Nature happens in cycles. So it kind of made sense that like the Forest Queen, a living being that like has thoughts and a personality and opinions, would be something that is literally representative of the marriage between humanity and nature, imposing like kind of our ideas and values on nature and the way nature kind of nurtures us and all of that. So the idea of the true cycle of the Forest Queen and the changeling being the Forest Queen saves a changeling, raises the changeling. The changeling eventually marries the maiden and they have a child, and that child is kind of the godhood that belongs to the Forest Queen. So like it also kind of ensures that the power of the Forest Queen is rooted in the essential kindness. But like Skyjax is a world of like broken stories and compelling stories and shifting stories and changing stories. So obviously that can be manipulated. And the sort of dark changeling's tale that is at the center of Hazards of Love and that inspired Travis's story is the broken story, is the unnatural one, is one where like selfishness kind of overwhelms the whole situation. And it creates another story that like is important, talks about like overbearing, you know, feeling like you deserve somebody else to control somebody else's life and that they should live to your accord and the danger that it presents to everybody involved in that situation. But that also really disconnects it from stories about the normal cycle of nature. So I really like the idea of broken stories, the idea of changing stories, and kind of how that overall bridges the gap for the Forest Queen as a figure and a luminary, and, you know, ties into how the mechanics of the world work and how they depend on stories and shift with stories. I think it's really cool, and I've been so excited for people to discover that as, like, the plot sort of coincides more with, like, luminaries and you know, almost like luminary hacking, how people have taken advantage of, like, these fundamental principles of the world of Sphere in different ways, and sort of how, you know, Travis as a main character has been a victim of that, but kind of has the opportunity to own it in a way and, you know, forge his own destiny. So, you know, I have been excited to, like, I've been excited for about it for a long time, but I really, because of the thing that happened with the Morrigan, I've been excited that that little detail was out there, and I wanted to expand on it, but, like, obviously, I think it is important in a lot of fiction, especially serialized fiction like this, when you have earth-shattering revelations, that characters get time to absorb them. If you move from one revelation to another, I think it starts to lose meaning and lose impact, because the characters never get a chance to regulate, never get a chance to decide and reinforce who they are. So yeah, I've been looking forward to that, and, like, because of our timeline shift and all of that, it became necessary to get more of that information out there now so that characters would be able to make decisions about it and act on it and have conversations around it. So I was happy with that. I was also happy, like, we got so much information about Gable and their relationship with the Morning Star, and, you know, the things that prompted them to slay the Sovereign. It was also kind of important to, like, build on more of the mythology, because, like, very, very early on, I had decided that Rusalka was a Fallen. And, like, I really tied that very tightly into the core mythology of the world in ways that, like, probably, you know, will never be explained to anybody but me, or, you know, and maybe behind the scenes discussions long after all of this is over. But, like, yeah, I was thinking about Fallen as figures and, you know, where they went, especially with Gable being immortal. You know, if there are other beings out there like Gable, why haven't we seen more of them? And, you know, Liz was pretty firm and, like, you know, being isolated, and the Starfall representing, like, thousands of angels falling from heaven, like, had to figure out why they aren't present. You know, and it's easy to figure out why beings would be in hiding, but, like, even then you can run into beings in hiding. Like, there is a reason that Gable and Travis continually ran into each other over and over again over 200 years. It's just, you kind of, if you're hiding, you fall into places, and you probably find folks who are similar to you. And so we had to work on those different explanations. And part of it is, you know, the Rusalka being a Fallen that happened before the fall of the stars found a different niche, and, like, obviously focused on building a place for herself in Sphere that, like, made her into a luminary. And I think her story is interesting and compelling, you know, being a being who, like, was cast down for an act of mercy in defiance of the Sovereign's will, and then spent a lot of time on Sphere itself, like, exploring wrath, but wrath according to themselves. I think it's an interesting juxtaposition because, you know, Gable, also an angel of justice, and is also kind of figuring out what morality even is, and, you know, is up against this big challenge, and, like, yeah, it was arguably very justified. Not even arguably, I think personally, me, it's justified to slay the Sovereign, because of what the Sovereign was and how the Sovereign behaved. But, like, that caused a bunch of unintended problems and consequences, and Gable is, like, sorting through those, and, like, being an angel, a being that is compelled to both mercy and justice, being pushed in those directions, and, having to decide for themselves what those things mean. Like, I think it is interesting to have Rusalka be there as like a being that has decided, and maybe in ways that Gable doesn't necessarily approve of or agree with. You know, also comes up to like the deal that Rusalka offered Gable that Gable did not take. And I was frankly very surprised that Gable didn't take it. I had like kind of planned that that was going to happen. But like, you know, players make decisions. And that is one of the things that is wonderful about RPGs. So that was really interesting. Yeah. But this is also an area where we hit a time crunch, because I did kind of want to have a melee on the beach, a showdown with the Cutting Stone, but it just didn't make sense. Like, I love having action as kind of a visceral expression of emotion. The Nordia fight, for instance, being this, like, release of all the anxiety and like kind of climax and compounding of all the anxiety that is built around that arc. The Silver Bullet arc, the fight there, like there being elements of like paranoia and betrayal that are running as undercurrents for that. Obviously, like the joust with Tiberius, you know, resolving all of the anger and frustration that came out of Dreth's death. Like, I think combat in RPGs is great, and an actual play is great and can be great. I think it needs to really be supporting something. I think of like martial arts films and action films almost the same way I think of musicals, where in a musical, a song happens because there's so much emotion pressing down on a particular moment. There is no way that it can move forward without expressing itself in song. All those songs mean something. They're there to tell you something about the story, the characters, where they are in their emotional journey. I think of fights the same way. And that's how I prefer they be used. And that means they need time to breathe. That means they need time to unfold in interesting ways. Like, a song in a musical has to be an interesting piece in and of itself. Like, the best songs are the ones that you can listen to in the soundtrack outside of the sequence of events and still like have a good time jamming out to them. And that's also how I think of combat. And if it can't do that, if it does not serve those purposes, then I think it feels empty. And like, I don't want to do it. I would much rather move past it. And, you know, we did not have time for Jonnet to really face the Mariner alongside Wei. We didn't have time for everybody there to like square off against the Cutting Stone. So instead, we kind of skipped past those because like we are looking towards other action beats that will serve other better purposes. And I'm okay with that. You know, I think I did see some folks in the audience talking about how they would have preferred the action to be run differently right there. It's just that's not at all what I am interested in doing. I don't think it's dynamic, fun, or cool. And like the stakes are almost pretend in my mind, like in that way. Because, you know, we know the results of certain things. Like, it is insane for me with the stories that we're telling to have a character die because of bad luck in a role. And also Genesis, frankly, as a system, does not work that way. So the combat just for combat's sake isn't really doing anything and isn't really going anywhere. I think like the moment actually with Polaris and Jonnet like striking down Polaris on the beach in that flashback, that to me, even though it's a scene that like we're in the future, this is in the past. We absolutely know what happens. We know Jonnet doesn't die on that beach. We know that Polaris goes down because it's a memory of Jonnet killing someone for the first time. That is more interesting to me than any random combat scene set in the present where the stakes might be life or death, because, you know, they're frankly not, and they got no fucking teeth. I don't know. And I think that is different, I think, for me and the way I view actual play than a lot of other people, but it's core to my philosophy. I think overall, this arc felt really good to me. There were so many really cool moments that after editing, you definitely saw more of the strength of these things than like the weakness of things that like I wish we'd done or wish we'd gotten to. You know, overall, I think Dumignon was such a cool location, and I really wish we had been able to sink in more. But I also think that the way in which we expedited things, like I think it also still resulted in strong narrative that I feel very good about. And I think it tied together so well. I loved all of the music in this arc. I loved the way that it drove and reflected the plot. I loved all of Casey's editing on this arc. I think, you know, it shines through stronger than ever, like why Casey is such a talented and skilled editor, the way that he makes his voice heard through editing and enhances everything that's happening in the narrative through his editing. It turned out really well, even though it was a massive logistical problem. Like on the production editorial side, I will let you know that because everything had to be recorded this way in like separate instances, and we weren't just handing Casey chronological audio, this arc was a much bigger challenge. We had to get our normal pass for things is audio will go to Joe, who, you know, you're if you've watched one-shot streams in the past, you're familiar with Joe, usually runs like the production board, did it all for like the whole run of TPK and all of that. Joe does a edit that removes a lot of background noise and creates a much cleaner sound for everyone. And in many cases, will align the tracks for Casey. Then in normal circumstances, it gets passed right to Casey. In these circumstances, because audio and sequences of the show had to be aligned, it first went to Tracy, who is our project manager over at OneShot, who has been, you know, really stepping in and making sure that OneShot, the podcast, is running while I am on paternity leave or on partial paternity leave, still working, mostly looking after the baby. Tracy would work with Casey to make sure scenes were aligned. And because music played such a huge role, then there had to be extra coordination with Arnie to make sure tracks were ready. And there had to be coordination between both Arnie and Tyler, who were, you know, creating a more complete version of the song that they had worked on together for air, and also Arnie and Lex, who Arnie was, you know, working with Lex on the music that actually went into the final episodes of Skyjacks to make sure they fit the sound and feel of the world. So there's a lot of communication, a lot of coordination, more so than any arc that we've done to date. It was a big challenge that could have gone many different ways, and I think it went in a really good direction. I'm very proud of it and happy with it. And like, it feels a little ridiculous now to be sitting here in the future, even though there were challenges associated with this arc and like so much other stuff that I was thinking about that was actually like working against the arc. It came together very well, and I'm so proud of it. So
in the universe of Starwall Odyssey, space is made out of the collective imaginations of all the thinking beings who live on various planets. These worlds are connected to each other through imagination. Common themes and ideas are strings between universes. And to get between them, people fly wooden ships that look like animals, which are powered by emotions. Also, people communicate with each other by contemplating orbs. The only way you can take pictures is getting stared at by a big psychic bug. And people have already declared victory in a war over the very concept of evil. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Starwall Odyssey follows the adventures of the hapless inhabitants of the Lucky Finn tenement building, who suddenly find that their apartment is actually a spaceship, and that they're lost in a sea of boundless imagination. It's an actual play starring me, James D'Amato, Mel D'Amato, Ali Grauer, and Drew Merzieski, as we playtest the No Kings system, which will hopefully one day be the Skyjacks role-playing system. It toes the line between weird and wonderful slice of life and high-flying space fantasy. You can sample the first 5 episodes by searching for Star Wall Odyssey on your favorite podcast app, or get the whole thing by heading to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast and signing up for $5 a month or more.